Welcome, everyone, to this week's episode of the Fell Into Food podcast with me, your host, Chef Jeff Fell. We took a week off. We had a busy National Restaurant Association show with a lot going on, a lot to get prepped. So we were out last week, but we are back at the show. We were talking a lot of dry aged meat, fish, and everything in that world. And it just so happens that this week I happen to have an expert who had a restaurant that was designed all about curing and drying meats. So let's get right into this week's episode with Chef Steve McHugh. HospitalityChain.com, the world's first online hub designed for the hospitality, culinary, and catering industry. From leading food and beverage brands to professional food service equipment, HospitalityChain.com makes sourcing simple. Search, select, buy direct, and save. All in one global marketplace. You just have done so much. Maybe we'll just start just quick on the background, you know, to kind of set the stage of the caliber of everything. And then I really want to jump into a lot of the science with aging and curing, because as I've gone along my journey, I am trying to figure things out, and I know that you are an expert in this area.
Expert. We'll get into that.
So yeah, talk me through a little bit of the background with the growing up in the dairy farm, you know, how you kind of ended up in, you know, the fine dining scene.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. It's not your typical, you know, I got to cook with grandma when I was a child and I just fell in love with cooking. And, you know, it's not one of those stories, right? So I grew up a dairy farm. Both my parents were working professionals, but we also had a working farm. So it was a lot, but I have six brothers. And so they kind of had built in farmhands, all the time. And, so it was great. One of the things, kind of one of the rules in our house is when you turn 14, you went and got yourself a work permit and you had to get a job. So that was my 14th birthday, was going to the high school to, sign up for, a work permit and getting work. And then, I ended up, my first job was working on a neighbor's farm, working the cornfields. It was so funny though, because my dad's very old school, and it wasn't just, hey, go down there and ask for a job. It was, first thing you're going to do is you're going to write to your neighbors. And you're going to ask for letters of recommendations. So I had to, like, dear Mr. Jordan, you know, I had to, like, handwrite letters, dear, you know, then wait for them to get mailed back, and then take those and then mail a letter to, this was Speckman Farms down the street. So I had to mail a letter to Mr. Speckman that I wanted to get a summer job, working on his farm. And here are my letters of recommendation, and all of this stuff. Right. I mean, this is just to, like, walk cornfields and detassel corn, right? I tell you what, it taught me a lot about, like, how things work and how they should work, and some of the things I miss as an owner operator that I wish people would do, you know, have a little bit more sense about getting a job. So that was a huge lesson at 14. What I also learned at 14 was that I did not want to work on a farm. So I did that for a year. And I wanted to do anything else. It could have been anything. And I had an older brother that was working at a nearby youth camp that had kitchens. And he was waiting tables there, you know, waiting tables, like, you know, cleaning up tables and setting up buffets. But he said they're looking for a dishwasher. And I said, perfect, I'll do it. Anything's better than walking around in a, you know, 100-degree heat in cornfields all day long and then having to ride my bike home. So I did that. And I loved it. And you've probably heard this before and you probably can relate, like, you kind of find this instant family in the kitchen, right? And you either really love it or you really dislike it. And those that really love being in kitchens, you kind of form this bond, and it doesn't matter. I've worked in, you know, cafeterias, I've worked in catering companies, casinos, hotels, fine dining restaurants, own my own kitchen. You find this camaraderie with the people who are kind of side by side you. And I would never, you know, I'm not disrespectful enough to compare it to, like, being in the military, but there's something about just knowing the people around you have your back. And it's a great feeling. And, you know, a lot of times the kind of screw ups like you were and you are, and you know, maybe struggled in school and are looking for that thing that gets them excited. So it's always a lot of fun. You meet so many different people. And since I was 15 years old, I have never been in a kitchen, and it's a long time. I'm not going to tell you how old I am, but it's a long time.
Yeah, the farm thing is so interesting. I grew up on a farm too, and it was the same thing. There was three of us boys, built in workforce. We didn't have to get a permit at 14, although I got my first real job at 15, and yeah. I think I still had to have it signed off. I had to have it signed off on. I worked at my buddy's gas station. His parents owned the gas station. And what was ironic is that was kind of like my intro, because we had a little one of those, like, before, like, convenience stores were what they are today with, like, food. Yeah. We had, like, the Hunt Brothers Pizza and Broster Chicken. Yeah. So I was around food, but, like, I didn't really equate it to, like, where I'm at today until I really look back. But uh-huh. It's just so funny hearing, you know, that it's, no, get a job, work hard, like, that the ethic that is instilled at such a young age in the farming community.
It's crazy. And, you know, we had a very small farm. You know, we had 50 acres, and, you know, I went to one of those, like, high schools where the kids who had the really big farms and who were milking hundreds of head, they would skip at least first period, if not second period. Like, they had waivers that said, you know, like, they're not, my wow. son will not show up until, you know, 9:30 or 10 o'clock. And you used to think, oh, it's bullshit, you know. Oh, sorry. But that's like,
no, you're fine.
You know, yeah, you think that's BS, but then you got to remember that kid's probably been up since 5 a.m., you know, out working and showing up at 10 o'clock to go to school. And then, you know, you're with that young man at football practice after school. And then, you know, they've got to go home and do homework. And so we didn't have it as bad as those kids, right? And those were the ones who just, like, you didn't mess with. They were, like, they were country strong, right? You just, you knew they were forces. And you know, I don't keep up with a lot of the folks back then, but, you know, they're probably still very successful at whatever they're doing today. They're probably very hard workers, and they're probably very successful.
Yeah, it translates into any industry you go into when you have that work ethic yeah. instilled. I know that's how it was with me. No matter what I went into, I was in retail for a while, and it was just like, be the best, whatever it yep. was, cashier, department, whatever, just be the best at what you can. So you had that background. You end up in New Orleans, right, with John Besh?
Yeah, so when I graduated high school, I attempted to go to college. I was really into music. I had a music scholarship, but I did not care for it. I just was not a good student. And college was even worse than high school, because you're in a classroom with 200-300 people, you know, listening to lectures. And I don't learn like that, right? I'm a hands-on person. So I left college, went back home, was back in kitchens. I was working like two jobs full time. And I think at the time it was because I just didn't want to run into my parents, you know? So I was like, I'd sneak in at night, go to sleep, get up super early and be back out to work. It wasn't like I was out partying all night, right? I was just like, I got to work. They're going to kick my ass for being here, you know? And eventually my dad said, why don't you go to culinary school? You seem to love restaurants so much. And I mean, you got to imagine, like, I grew up in a town that was like 1600 people. Right. I didn't know what a chef was. I didn't know what culinary school was. And thank God my dad was so wise. Right. And so I applied and I ended up getting in at the CIA in New York. And so that's where I went. And it just was, you know, it's funny because, like, going to upstate New York's like going to Wisconsin. I mean, it's very, like, rural and farmy. And, you know, it's just they have mm-hmm. prettier leaves and, you know, a nice river that runs through the Ohio Valley there. But other than that, it was like kind of like I, you know, I was like, oh, I'm around farms and, you know, kind of rural area. But it was nice to be able to take the train down to the city and go eat places and go see things. And yeah, so I did my externship with the CIA down in New Orleans, and I just fell in love with that city. I couldn't wait to get back. And I went back as soon as I graduated. I just was like, this was awesome. Had so much, I, you know, you go and do an externship, right, where you, through the school, you've got to go work 5 months in like an accredited location, right? So I went to the Hilton there, and I just knew the city had so much more to teach me. I couldn't wait to get back. My mind was blown with the food, the cuisine, the people, the music, the everything. It was like I left the country. It was so cool.
Yeah. And then you ended up moving to Texas. You opened your restaurant through a whole whirlwind of personal shit, you know, lymphoma. And then you got through that. That's crazy. And again, it's important to know. I don't want to go down that rabbit hole because, again, I want to talk about it. But, you know, it obviously changed you or made you think about what you were going to do. But why did you continue, or why did you say, okay, I'm going through this, but I'm still going to open a restaurant? Because you were literally in the thick of it when you opened Pearl, right? Or Cured?
Yeah. So when I had opened Cured, I had just finished my treatment. So I had moved to, as you mentioned earlier, I was working for John Besh and I was a corporate chef for him and opened probably 7 or 8 restaurants with him and came to Texas to open a restaurant for him and was diagnosed, did all that, got his restaurant open, finished my chemo, and then was like, I need to go do for myself. And so I started going down that path and this opportunity fell into my lap to do a restaurant at the Pearl. And I had an idea of what I wanted. I kind of, you know, I think a lot of times people, you know, I kind of maybe work backwards, but I wrote the menu and the type of things that I wanted to do and then went from there. Right. I think a lot of times people say, okay, I want to open an Italian restaurant and go write a menu. For me, I just started brainstorming. I had 300, 400, 500 ideas on paper. I was, look at this. I saw this in a magazine and I was just that, you know, this scrapbook of stuff and just like, oh, this looks cool. And I started narrowing it down. Okay, well, you know, what if I buy whole pigs? Okay, well, what do I do with that? And then I got to figure out how to use everything. Well, I could do the same thing with goats and lamb and fish and all these things, right? So it's just like now the list is growing again and you really start to kind of think about it. So I ended up with kind of this menu and it was very charcuterie focused. It was very cured food heavy. It was a lot of fermentation and pickling and salting and we just couldn't come up with a name. And we were in the old administrative building of the Pearl Brewery. And so we kind of landed on admin, like the admin, you know, like that sounds cool. That sounds fun, you know, and there's a story behind that. And my architect at the time, he goes, excuse me. He goes, you know, I went to college with a guy who owns a PR firm in Austin. He's one of the best there is. He goes, I think you should meet with him. And I think, you know, I think y'all should talk. So I was like, okay, not a PR firm, excuse me, a branding firm. And I said, yeah, okay. And so I met with Jet. He owns a company called Photo Studios. And we talked and he came to our house and we cooked and we just hung out for a day. He goes, I just want to know about you. I want to know about, you know, you and your wife and your family and what you do and show me around your neighborhood and show me around the city and show me what excites you and take me to the restaurants that you like and what do you like about them? And just, you know, I was like, oh, okay. That seems odd, but whatever. Yeah, let's do it. You know? So we just hung out. By the end of the day, we were like best friends. And I had mentioned my journey, right? My cancer journey. And he came back probably 2-3 weeks later and he's like, I've got it. I've got a deck for you. I'm going to present some stuff to you. And I let's see what you think. And he starts going through it. You know, here's where you're from and here's where you are. And here's this. And he goes, this is what I think you should call the restaurant. You should call it Cured. And I was like, oh my God. It was like right there the whole time, you know? And, yeah.
Yep.
And you know, it's like, I don't know who said it, but sometimes it's, you know, the smart thing to do is know you're not smart enough, you know, and like it's kind of stay in your lane kind of thing. And so I see it all the time now. Like when I go by a restaurant, I'm like, the chef named that restaurant. I can tell it's kind of a dumb name or whatever it is, you know what I mean? Because you're just like, come on. And I've always, you know, I've always thought like, wow, here's somebody who took the time to get to know me and my wife and our concept as opposed to just being like, yeah, I'll come up with a cool name for you. Right. I can do that. Yeah. It's going to cost you, you know, $5,000. And, you know, he came to us and said, here's what I think your branding should look like. Here's the name. Here's your color palette. Here's this, you know, I got pictures of the building. I know what it used to be painted like. Here's your color palette. We're going to throw back to the building that was built in 1904. There used to be penny tile in that building. I think we could do a cool mosaic with cured written in the penny. Like all of these things, like you did all this research and it wasn't just like this, like, yeah, I'll take care of it. I do this all the time. It was like, no, this is personal and this is special and this is yours and it belongs to you. So that's where the name came up. People all the time think I'm some sort of genius because I came up with this name, this double entendre, right? But you know, I paid for that and it was money well spent.
Yeah, it's I have said all the time, like even my brand, you know, I to your point, I had all these dumb ideas now that I look back of what it was gonna be named. I don't remember how many hours I spent, and then my wife says, no, it's Fell Into Food. And I was like, son of a bitch. Yeah, I was like, as soon as she said it, it hit. And I was like, damn it. That's the name. Like, you just know that it is what it is. And so it's like, well, don't fight, you know, to your point, don't fight it when you know it's the right thing.
Yeah.
Let's dive into, aging, curing the whole nine yards. And let's maybe set the stage for the listeners that aren't chefs, that don't do this stuff. And what's ironic and really funny actually is I have a lot more chefs that, as I've been doing this more and more, reach out with questions. And I say it in a place of like, I didn't go through like the traditional background like a lot of you guys did. You know, I went into education, right, feeding, high volume, and had to learn this just kind of my own by reading books and seeing what was available. But it's just interesting now to see some of these guys that kind of are in the space and they're still like, well, you know, what kind of mold development are you working on and how do you handle it and what are your temperatures and humidities? And you're just like, oh, I figured you would know all that kind of stuff. I just know enough to help promote, you know, a meat cabinet. So
right,
what's the difference, I guess, talk about what's the difference between curing meat and aging meat?
Yeah.
And then we'll dig deeper from there.
Well, and I'll even go back further than that is that, you know, As corporate chef with BRG in New Orleans, I worked with Alon Shaya when we first opened Dominica, which was John's Italian concept. And Alon had gone to Italy and he came back and him and I, we started working on recipes and we started just kind of really getting into it. I learned a lot from him. He wanted to have a charcuterie case designed and built. And so we contacted a company that kind of built wine cabinets. And they said, yeah, we can build one, but it won't have like, you know, humidity controls and all those things. And Alon was like, I'll figure all that stuff out in the back. I just need something pretty up front where I can display everything. So fast forward, you know, 5-6 years later, I go to that same company and I say, hey, I want a charcuterie cabinet. I want one like you built for us in New Orleans, but I need humidity controls. I'm dealing with a Texas health department here. This isn't New Orleans where they just kind of wander around. You give them a free po' boy and they're on their way, right? I mean, these SOBs are tough here, right? So they said, we can figure that out. We can do that. And I need it to be calibrated. I need to do HACCP controls and all these things. Well, I still had to pencil whip all the HACCP programs and all the temperature and everything, but they built one with humidity controls in it, which was great. It saved me so much time and energy. Now, you know, I operated that restaurant for 12 years. We just closed back in January. But fast forward 12 years now, you know, these chefs that are out there, they can buy a plug and play and they've got everything at their fingertips. It's absolutely amazing. I didn't have that option back in 2013, right? I had to figure it out. And I would just be like, I'd go into a friend's restaurant and I'd see him dry aging. I'm like, you sons of, you know, that's bull. I have to do it myself. But anyways, so for me, curing, and I learned, I trained under Brian Paulson, who wrote Charcuterie and who wrote Cured, the two most like quintessential cookbooks for people like us who want to get into these types of things. And Brian came down here and I did, I think 3 days with him, just from whole pig down to like, here's 30 items. I mean, it was like the coolest thing. And I learned a lot from him. And the one thing he taught me was like 60 degrees, 60% humidity, 60, 60, 60, 60, 60. Just drill that into your brain, right? And, you know, I'm at that, you know, age with like kind of like the Uber commercials where I got to learn something, I need to forget something, right? So I'll never forget like 60, 60, 60, you know? And so that's kind of what I did. And curing for us is like understanding the science behind kind of osmosis and salting. Your water is your enemy in any type of preservation, whether it's, you know, smoking, making kimchi, dehydrating, sugaring, salting, whatever. Water is the enemy, because water is what sustains all life, including, you know, those molds that harbor in moisture. So your goal is to decrease the water. And by doing that, we salt. And, you know, Ryan was, you know, there's two types of school of thoughts, right? You've got kind of what they call salt box method or EQ curing. Equilibrium curing. Anyways, basically EQ curing is taking the weight of something, multiplying by a certain number. You know how much salt you need to put on it. And then salt box is basically taking that piece of meat, covering it with enough salt so that you know nothing will go wrong. And there's less science there. There's less math, let's say, right? Same science, but less math. So Brian taught us salt box method, where just cover it in a bunch of salt. It can only pull out so much moisture. Now, the longer you go, the saltier it'll get. Of course, it's like anything, but there's only so much moisture that's going to come out. So with curing, it's about adding salt. Now, you can add stuff to that, black pepper and coriander and lime zest or whatever, right? But it's the salt. And you're trying to pull moisture out. With dry aging, you're doing the same thing, but you're not adding salt to it. Okay. And don't do 60 and 60 with dry aging. Okay. You need it to be down at refrigeration temperature.
Yes. Yes. Let's make that very clear. When you said 60, 60, I was like, oh, we better clarify that dry aging, we want much colder temperatures versus doing salumis and other curing.
And here's a fun story. It's kind of how I got into dry aging, because I didn't do dry aging when we first opened the restaurant. It was just not on my radar. I love dry aging. I always loved it. And I would order dry aged steaks whenever I went out and had the opportunity. But when COVID hit, nobody knows what's going to happen, right? We were all just kind of like, well, now what do I do? Well, I've got, you know, thousands of pounds and thousands of dollars worth of meat being cured. And so for 3 months, we ran basically a curbside operation where we were selling charcuterie platters to go. I had walls full of jarred pickles and I had mustards already canned up. I mean, I had so much stuff in the restaurant because we were basically, our whole philosophy was preservation. So we spent months just carving and making, you know, pâtés and getting rid of lomos and jamons and salamis and just building charcuterie platters, and people come buy them from the side door. We did that for like 3 months. Well, our hams take 2 years, and we got to the end of 3 months and our case was empty. Now we have a case that's the first thing you see when you walk into the restaurant. It's 11 feet wide by 9 feet high. And it was empty. And then all of a sudden you get, you know, the governor saying, hey, you can reopen. I'm like, well, now we don't have any fucking meat. You know, now what do we do? it's not like these things you can just do it like that, right? So my wife had the brilliant idea. She said, well, why don't we dry age? We can fill it up with steaks. And I was like, yeah, okay. That's a great idea. So we filled it up. You know, I called up one of my ranches that I work with. I need strips. I need ribeyes, whatever you can send me, you know, and we filled the case up. So you'd walk in, it looked like you're walking into like a Vegas steakhouse. There was so much beef in there, right? But at least the case was filled up. Now I had to turn the case down. I had to take it down to 42. I adjust the humidity a little bit. And it, people loved it. It took off. And I was like, I don't want to not do dry aging, but I also need to make sure I'm curing, right? And so we ended up doing both in the same case, and I just never turned it back up to 60. And what happens is you can still cure at 42 degrees. It just takes twice as long. So like I said, our hormones that used to take us 12 months took us like 24. Our salamis would take us like 90 days when they would take us 45. So it just prolongs the process, but you're still gathering, you're still, the molds can still survive, the good ones. You're still getting the water loss. And for us, that's the other thing that Brian taught me was that 30% weight loss. So that's your marker. If you put a 20-pound ham in there after you've cured it, 20% loss. Okay. Excuse me, 30% loss. You need it to lose. So we would weigh everything a couple times a month. Everything in the case got weighed. And then we would mark it. So if the health department would say, you know, we could say, here's where the temperature's been, here's our humidity, here's our loss. And we would see those numbers creeping up because we were doing the dry aged beef. But the dry aged beef, one, didn't take as long, and two, it was such a moneymaker, right? And at a time where, you know, coming out of COVID, it's like we got to get these check averages up a little bit. You know, we needed people to spend some money, so you get a nice dry aged strip. And the great thing was, we were doing it at a time where we could do it cheaper than everybody else because everybody else was buying dry aged, so they're paying that marked up price. Well, we're doing our own, and then we're taking the trim and we're making fun things with the trim, or we're using it to make our bordelaise or our stocks, or, you know, fortifying sauces, what have you. So we were able to kind of make a little more money at the same time. And so it became such a moneymaker for us. And like I said, at that time, there were no plug and play options. So we were doing it in-house, which was unheard of. Unless you had a customized case, like I say, in Vegas, they're everywhere, but like you just didn't see it. And it was such a profitable thing for us. So we ended up doing both in the same environment. Now, is that always ideal? Not necessarily. Because you do get a lot of temperature fluctuations. You get, when you load in a bunch of charcuterie, you add a bunch of moisture to the case, and you got to try and get it out as quick as you can. You don't want your beef to get wet, and vice versa. As you put, you know, 300 pounds worth of beef in there, you're adding moisture to the environment. It becomes this thing where sometimes it can be hard to manage. I even got to the point where I had a built-in dehumidifier, but I bought a little small one at like Academy, you know, where I could plug it in and hide it in the corner and then just empty it every day, because I'm like, I got to get moisture out of here because we just loaded up, you know, with a bunch of beef. So it's not always ideal, but it's possible. But like I said, doing the beef slows down your charcuterie and vice versa. You can really screw some things up. They did benefit from each other's mold, which was really cool. So I think we got some really cool flavors in our dry aged beef that were like maybe coming off the charcuterie. When we first started working, there's a meat distributor in Austin that we were working with the last few years, and they had their own dry aging room, and they were nice enough to send me a bunch of their trim, and I kind of laid it out on sheet pans and put it in the bottom of the case for about 2 weeks and let some of their mold spores kind of get up in there. That's the other thing. Your environment's so delicate that we never, you know, I don't want to say we never cleaned our case, but like if we ever had to like clean up a little blood spot or the glass got smudgy or whatever, we would just use straight vodka and clean that one little area. And then that was it, because we didn't want to like disinfect our environment in there. It was so valuable, especially after 12 years in business. I mean, it was just so much cool stuff happening. So
a couple things. Mold is not the enemy, people. I tell that all the time. I was just at the NRA show, and people are seeing, you know, it was a good noble mold. I'd grown, got growth on there, and people are like, what in the hell? I was like, you need mold. If you're going to actually dry age, the actual process of changing the meat, we need mold. Yep. And then two, there's a product in Europe that I want to get brought over. It's called Aquasol. And what it is, it's just water, but the pH, they ionize it to like some crazy, like 12, 13. It's like some super high. And the chefs use it over there because it doesn't disinfect. It's able to clean, but it leaves everything in its current state because it's just water, but with a higher pH level. And
the alkaline is so
I've been trying to find something in the States. Yeah, yeah. But we haven't been able to figure out a way because I'm like, man, if we could get that here, it would really help. Because to your point, yeah, you clean it all out. Every time I clean a cabinet, 100%, well, now it's like starting over from scratch. And now I've got to put a piece in there and I have to, you know, inoculate that cabinet. Yeah. Maybe just talk about that. I mean, you said put scraps in it, and I use that word inoculate, and people just go, "What in the hell are you talking about?"
Yeah.
So maybe talk about what that process is, what we're doing to the environment.
Of course, and then like I could, you know, the types of molds and the names. You know, if I was smart enough to remember all that, I probably wouldn't be a chef. But I always say this, and it's, I think it's even in my book, like as humans, we are equipped to know when food is not good. And people worry so much about like, well, what if it's bad? It's like, you'll know if it's bad. We didn't survive, you know, millions and millions of years, by guessing. We smell when things are off. We taste when things don't taste right. You can see when something doesn't look right. We would always say white molds, great, blue, green, black, anything that's really off in color, get rid of it. And it happens, right? There are so many touch points, in making a salami, thousands. And, you know, from washing your hands to a clean cutting board, to a clean knife, to, a sheet pan, to a sheet rack, to what's in your walk-in while you've got it salting, you know, the bus tub, whether it's metallic or plastic. I mean, there's so many touch points where something can go wrong. And like I said, we are equipped to know, like, that don't look good, you know, or that don't smell good. You know, as humans, we have those. And we've gotten so sanitized and sterile in our environments that we forget to rely on our own senses. We're so, you know, well, that's a health department's job. Oh, yes, they have a job to do. But as a human, you know, you should know if you're, and it's happened to me. I've been eating a piece of fish and I'll go, nope. This fish is bad. And people at my table will be like, really? I'm like, yep, I'm not eating this. You know, I've done it enough times. I've been around it enough times. I know when tomatoes aren't ripe or aren't good anymore, whatever it is. So you're seeing these white molds, these normal molds. A lot of them are natural in the air. There are products that you can spray on there, or you can soak them, you know. And then you hear about this where chefs are like trading molds sometimes, and that's what we did with Lone Star Meats, because you know I walked their curing room and I'm like, and there's only about, I mean it's a big room and there's probably 7 or 8 restaurants that use it, and I'm looking at like, well, that's Jeffries and Austin's, and that's you know, so-and-so in Houston, that's Blue Door in there. And that's, I forget, you know, and you're just like, these are some bad dudes that are getting their meats aged here. Like they know what's going on. Like I said, I was lucky enough to have my own system. So I was just like, I told my Lone Star guy, I was like, I need some of this mold, you know, and you just let it bloom in the environment. But it kind of, and it wants to land on like something new and kind of feed itself. And with the molds, it's doing so much, right? One, it's breaking down the product. And that's going to make that product more palatable, more tender. If we're talking about a dry aged steak, you're going to get a better tooth, a better chew, right? It's adding flavor. Okay, it's creating gases, almost alcoholic enzymes that are creating flavor. So a lot of times when people say, "Why are you adding mold to your salami?" Well, that's where the flavor comes from, right? Yes, I'm adding salt and black pepper and maybe some fennel pollen and what have you, right? But it's getting flavor from these molds. It's the byproduct, right? It's converting those sugars. And then it's also, if you've got a really good and healthy mold working in your case, it's keeping the bad, it's keeping those bad actors away. And that's probably the biggest, most important,
yep,
is that it wants a healthy environment. It also doesn't want these bad actors coming near it. So it helps shield it, helps block it, but also at the same time, it will not allow something to come in there and spoil its environment, right? And that's hugely important, because that mold wants to keep going. It wants to keep reproducing and keep going. And that's where it both curing and dry aging mold is our friend.
I was using the reference of, it's like healthy grass. If you have a healthy lawn and healthy grass, guess what? It chokes out the weeds. The weeds can't grow, and that's bad mold. And then when I put it that way, people are like, oh, okay, now I get it. I'm like, yes, we want those molds to help protect. And again, it's a flavor inhibitor to the product. So yeah, white mold, good. And to your point, black, blue, absolutely. Greens, you really got to know what you're looking for, you know, feeling. And again, smelling. To your point, I think it goes back to almost trusting your gut instinct. Even if you've never done it, you kind of look at it, you smell it, and you're like, that's off.
Yeah.
Because that's what happened at one of the farms I work with. We got a cabinet in, and I'm helping them through the process. And I went down after they had aged it for, I want to say, somewhere around 45 days. And I look at it and I go, that doesn't look right. I'm like, what do you mean? And I go, it looks wet still. It looks wet still. And I touch it and it's almost sticky. And I was like, oh God. And I kind of smell it. And I was like, yeah, this is not what we want after 45 days. And they're just like, what, really? And I was like, yeah. And come to find out, they had wet aged it. It'd been sitting wet aged for in a bag for 2 weeks, 3 weeks.
Oh, wow.
And then they cut it out and then they put it in there. And I was like, well, that had to attribute to them. You know what I mean? That everything had kind of pulled back into it. So, that was, I was like, well, that experiment, lesson learned. And they were just like, oh, we didn't know this. And again, you don't know what you don't know. So we work through those things. Yeah. Question for you on wet aging. I see on menus, right? Wet aging, the process of basically putting meat inside of usually a vacuum seal type bag, and then you're just letting it naturally break down and tenderize. You're not really changing the flavor. How far can you actually take wet aging?
I think it depends on your temperature controls. I've seen operations that can sit on primals for 30, 45 days in a really cold environment, almost like 1 or 2 degrees above freezing, where it's just cold and they're in there for a long time, right? But like, to your point, right, it's tenderizing it, but you're not getting that flavor that I don't think, you know, to me, once again, I've been doing it for a long time. I taste old meat. I taste something that's been in a cooler for a long time. And I know what, like, I can tell when I open a bag, and I can tell how old a product is. You know, like, it smells old. The blood is black, you know, real dark. Not the blood, but you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, the liquid that's coming off is really dark. The meat's kind of pliable, especially like you get a tenderloin that's really like, whoa, you know? For me, I don't like that. I've never been a fan of it. To me personally, like I said, it tastes old. And when we're dealing with things like, you know, our middles, our strips, ribeyes, tenderloins, we have to remember those are products that are, for the most part, designed to protect organs. And you start to taste those organ, you get that irony component from like a liver or the lungs. You start to taste that. I feel like, but it's probably because I've been around animals a long time, and I've cut a long time, and I've tried to cook every single bit of an animal you can think of. And so the longer that blood, if you will, right, sits, I start to taste that more and more. I start to get that irony taste that tastes like old meat. So I get it a lot in tenderloins if they've been aged, wet aged too long, because the tenderloin really sits right around all the organs. I mean, I always tell people, like, your loin and your tenderloin, you know, they basically, their job is to protect the spinal column. All mammals have them, and one sits on the outside, one sits on the inside, and it's a protection muscle, right? They're working muscles, but not like, you know, the arms and the legs and the neck of a cow or a pig, right? They don't work. They're really there for protection for the spinal column. And so I tend to get a lot of that organ taste if it's sitting in bloodstream.
What about the claims of, I had some people ask me, they're like, oh, we saw this thing and they said rapid dry aging. And I was like, you can't really wrap. I don't believe you can rapid dry age, but what are they trying? I mean, it's probably a marketing thing because they want to speed the process, but yeah. You know, what do you say when someone says, oh yeah, you know, we're going to rapid dry age?
Well, I mean, they're telling you that because one, they're saving you time and they're probably saving you money because there's probably, I would imagine, less loss, right? I mean, let's talk about that real quick. For those of you who haven't done it, you're probably looking at true dry aging, you're looking at 25 to 30% loss in a lot of cases, right? Well, that's a very expensive piece of meat to start with, and now I got to throw it away or, you know, put it in my soup, you know, or what have you, or make, you know. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, you're going to have people out there that are saying, oh, I can do it cheaper for you. Well, as we all know, cheaper isn't always better, right? But I would think if you're rapid dry aging something, you're probably more like dehydrating it. They've figured out a way to put fans all around it to pull moisture out quicker. But what happens is you end up creating a crust because you're just drying out the outside. And that's where you have to be careful. And that's where like a company like Medico has figured out like fan placement, fan speed, when dry aging a piece of fish versus a steak, it's more delicate with the fish, right? Because there's no skin, there's no fat, there's no, you know. So I would imagine with rapid dry aging, there probably is a bunch of fans that are just like pulling moisture out of the air quick. And, you know, they think they're helping it along, but at the same time, they're creating probably a dangerous environment where you're getting a dry crust around something. Now moisture can't get out, right? That's the purpose of not having a fan blowing directly on something. Even in my charcuterie case, we would block the fan so that we didn't get this crust, because now all of a sudden moisture can't get out. Well, moisture is the enemy. If it can't get out, you're going to get some off taste, some off flavors.
That makes perfect sense. And then you start to also potentially create fissures in the meat, or you know, cracks, if you will, that then stuff can get into. You see that all the time if it's gone too fast or too cold, and people are just they don't understand all these nuances. Let's talk fish for a minute. That was a big topic this year. I'm just getting into the practice of it with the scales and making sure it's clean. You know, what's your experience with fish?
A little bit. I've cured a lot more fish than I've dry aged. And fish is fun. It cures quick, right? We all know that. Like you can brine some beautiful snapper fillets for 20 minutes and it changes the flavor profile of that cooked fish like that. I mean, I've cured tuna for an hour and sliced it and put it on a plate, and people think it's like the most magical thing they've ever eaten. It's just like, it was really easy. It didn't take me 2 years. So curing for me is fun because, like I said, it's quick. Dry aging, I don't have a ton of experience with, but I'm super enthralled by it because the science is the same, right? We're going to take something, we're going to tenderize it, and we're going to pull moisture out of it, which, you know, fish are a lot of moisture. And we're going to intensify the flavors of that fish. And you get a lot of times people are just like, I don't know, all fish taste the same to me. That's true. But when you start to pull that moisture out, all of a sudden you start to pick up like, hey, this halibut's a little bit more gamier than that sea bass, or that snapper has some sweet notes to it, almost citrusy. And like, you start to like really go, oh, there's some really cool flavors in these fish. And so I've got some friends that do it. They absolutely love it. And one a friend of mine in Austin owns a sushi restaurant. He does almost all his fish now dry aged. And I have another friend of mine in Birmingham who does a lot of fish dry aged for his menu. And he has a seafood restaurant. So it's, for me, I love seeing it. It's, you know, I go back to the fact that, like, we tend to overregulate our food in this country a little bit. And so as consumers in the U.S., we get scared very easily by new ideas. Mm-hmm. And dry aging fish, I think, would probably scare the crap out of just about anybody. And so I think that's why it's taken so long for it to really take off, whereas you're seeing it Japan, Australia, all over Europe. You're seeing it with people who kind of just have these palates that haven't been dumbed down by, you know, sugars and fats and carbohydrates and corn syrups and things like that, right? But it'll get there. You know, I mean, there was a time where, you know, in this country where sushi was illegal after World War II, you know, because nobody understood it, right? So I think we'll get there. It's going to take people a long time. And once the U.S. government gets involved, it'll take even longer. So
what's interesting is I think a lot of people have had it. They just don't realize it, because I think a lot of sushi houses don't promote it because of the whole fear, the fear factor of, if I put this on my menu and I say it's the complete opposite of beef or pork. If I put that I dry age my fish, people instantly go, oh my God, they're aging and this fish has been sitting, hanging around for God knows how long. Because that's where their mind goes to. Because again, that's what you hear, you know, beef, when you're going 30, 60, 90, 120, you know, fish, depending on the restaurant, you know, I did a tuna tail 40 day and it came out fantastic. Absolutely fantastic. It was firm. I did almost like a Brajola out of it. And it was fantastic. Salmon. Beautiful. Yeah. Fennel pollen, dust, salt, pepper, fennel pollen, seared it, and then hit it with some lime zest and a little duck fat and ginger. And it was just vibrant and popped. And after I told everyone, you know, it's 40 days, they're just like, 40 days? I just ate 40 day fish. And I was like, yeah, you sure did. And they're like, this was one of the best things I've ever had. And I was like, because dry-aged fish is better than fresh fish. To your point, we've allowed the muscles to relax. We've allowed moisture to evaporate. Now that the way that you put it, it makes sense. You do actually taste different notes because of that fat and the actual muscle of the meat can actually shine because it's not being kind of drowned out from with all that excess water that's sitting inside of the structure of the meat. So you're definitely going to really taste it. And what was very interesting too is I've talked to some chefs and they said it also allows me to prolong my shelf life and the season of some of these seasonality type fishes, you know, and a spring cherry trout, right? I can only, you know, it's only in season for so long, but if I throw it in my cabinet, well, I can get another week or 2 weeks out of my product and I can actually take my menu a little bit further on a specialty item. And I never thought of it that way. They weren't just thinking about the flavor and quality. They were thinking I can actually sell more for longer than anyone else can because I'm doing this technique.
Yeah, it's smart. It's really smart.
Okay, Chef, in the grocery store, I see all the time uncured bacon. Like, what are they doing to actually say it's uncured? I always see a lot of debate of, well, you have to cure it to some degree to make it bacon. Yeah. But then people are scared to death of nitrates and all pink curing salts. So what is the take? What are they, you know, I know what's going on or what they're doing, but what's your take on uncured bacon and can you actually have an uncured bacon?
Right. Well, no. I mean, you know, I cure things all the time and don't use nitrates or nitrites, right? But when you're talking about things in a grocery store, you've got, especially things are ground, or if they have a lot of knife points on them. So what I mean is, if I'm taking a pork loin and I'm curing it, I've cut it two times, right? And I'm salting it. Mm-hmm. If I take something like a salami and I'm filling it with ground pork, I've cut it a million times. That one salami has, you know, a million cuts because every ground is cut, right? And so we tend to use nitrates and nitrites in situations where a lot can go wrong, like baking bacon or things that are sliced and things that are cut, things that are chopped up, because it helps really keep bad actors at bay. Okay. We've done a really good job in the grocery stores of leaning into people's fears. And we look for those buzzwords, right? So, you can pick up a pack of yogurt and it'll say gluten-free on it. Well, of course, it hasn't even been near the wheat field, you know? It's like, okay. But people see that and they go, oh, thank God, because I'm not eating gluten right now. I can have this yogurt. Mm-hmm. Once again, same thing with uncured products that are traditionally should be cured in order to be called bacon. So I always challenge people. I say, I want you to turn it over and look at the ingredients. And through our system, if you are curing with celery juice, celery powder, celery salt, you can call it uncured, even though celery juice, celery powder, celery salt naturally has nitrates in it. A lot of vegetables do. A lot of, celery just happens to be one that's very high in natural nitrates. So they're leaning into your fears, but they're curing it. Okay. if that answers the question. So they're lying. Let's just put it that way.
But is it healthy? I would assume it's healthier because it's a more natural derivative of the compound versus using the actual, nitrates or nitrites.
I don't want to say yes or no. I'm not sure if it's healthier. If I'm buying pink salt, I don't know if that pink salt actually came from celery. It could have. I'm not an expert. I'm not a food scientist like that. But I would dare say they're probably pretty equal. And I think if we really were to dig into it, there's probably, a USDA, FDA guideline out there that says if you use, this percentage, you can call it uncured. So if we were to really dig into it, you'd probably would find some stuff and go, this is BS. But I haven't done that. We will. Let's do it.
There you go. He debunked. It is cured, even if it says uncured. It's probably a labeling guideline that they have gotten around to some degree. So just know your uncured bacon is cured in some fashion because you got to cure it. Chef, what is next for you? The restaurant, closed in January. What's on the horizon? What do you got working on?
I've been doing a lot of personal stuff, which is great. Travel, housework, getting caught up on things, spending time with family. It's been great. 12 years was a long time. It was a lot of energy, a lot of effort. And I don't say I would ever do it again, but it's something that when I go by the restaurant, I'm like, yeah, I feel okay. Like I don't feel any kind of way. Like I did it. I enjoyed it. I had a lot of fun doing it and I'm ready to kind of do something else. Right now, career-wise, I've just been doing a lot of consulting. I've been helping a lot of other restaurants. Got some friends that are doing some projects outside of the state, some friends that are doing projects in the state, and I'm just kind of working hourly here at my desk at home and helping write recipes and menus. I still work with the San Antonio Spurs on their private club, so it's called Spurs Club. I'm a chef consultant for them. In fact, we just, as you know, we got our Medico fired up 2 weeks ago out there, and they are full on dry aging now for their customers. And I get probably 2 to 3 questions a day from my chef. Well, what's doing that? I'm like, just leave it alone. You're fine. It's changing. I know that's what you want. Send me a picture. Okay. Everything looks good. And then I'm going to be back out there in a couple of days because they're now into the next phase of the program that we fired up 2 weeks ago, and we helped get them programmed, and so they're really excited about it, and they love their Medico. It's beautiful. And then I have another one that we put at a local catering company that we're getting loaded up here in a couple of weeks. And they put it in their show kitchen. And this is one of one of the largest caterers in the South, and they're putting it in their show kitchen because they want to use it to kind of, you know, help land clients. You know, so it's been really cool. And like I said, I enjoy geeking out and learning the science behind things and the writing of the recipes, and I don't miss the 15-hour days, 6 days a week. So let's just
so safe to say, in the near future, there is probably not a restaurant on the horizon.
I don't think so. No, I've had a lot of offers come my way to open something new, and I'm taking my time to really enjoy this time, and I don't want to, you know, don't want to rush. So
that's so good to hear. I'm so glad you're doing well. If everyone wants to check what you got going on, your book, all that stuff, where do they go to find all that?
Yeah. I'm at Chef Steve McHugh. So that's STEVEMCHUGH, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. The book is called Cured. It's really cool. It's 8 chapters on preservation, and every chapter is a different way to preserve foods. So anything, you know, you can imagine, from fermenting to salting to freezing, even, you know, we preserve food with freezers. So that's available anywhere you can buy a book. Yeah, it's doing well, and it's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, go check the book out. I've read it myself. I have lots of copies. So if you're interested, hit me up. I can probably get you a copy. Definitely. But it is a fascinating book, because you also talk about your background, your history, and everything you kind of went through. So it ties it all together. So it is just a really, really good read. I'm glad I was able to geek out and nerd out with another fellow aging, curing chef, as again, it's a small club, really, of people who understand it. And it's as much, I believe, you know, art as it is science, trying to figure things out and how you're going to develop things and grow, you know, our molds and whatnot. So I really appreciate your time, Chef.
Thank you, brother.
And everyone watching, we'll put everything in the show notes, book, all of that good stuff. Make sure you follow us on YouTube, Spotify, Apple. And until next time, we'll catch you on the sunny side.